He told me, the friend recalls, that he was not prepared to exert the degree of influence over the administration and the mayor that he felt would be required of him in return. That he was not unprepared to exert a lesser degree of influence is indicated by the fact that some Triborough insurance began to be given to a new broker, one whom key Democrats considered close to the leader. But DiSapio's refusal to accept it all left a lot of commissions to be disposed of. Steingut, son of Steingut, spiritual heir to McCooey, and boss of the Brooklyn organization that the one-time butcher had carved into shape, received some, and, because a public authority was not by customary definition a part of government, could piously tell an inquiring reporter that he had never accepted government business. So did the Democratic leader of Queens, the Honorable James A. Rowe. In 1953, the year in which the Herald Tribune was stating that authorities are free from politics, three of the five county leaders of the machine that dominated the city's politics were therefore on Moses' payroll. There were enough insurance premiums left over for Republicans, and at least one of the GOP county leaders, John R. Cruz of Brooklyn, received some of them. As for the legislature, Moses used insurance premiums to ensure that his influence there would be exerted not only indirectly through the influence of Rowe, Steingut, and DiSapio over the legislators they controlled, but more directly through at least one of the small group of leaders who really ran the legislature, D. Mallory Stevens, a poor farm boy from Putnam County who in 1942 became chairman of the Assembly's Key Ways and Means Committee, which controls the flow of legislation to the floor, and in 1943 began receiving Triborough insurance business. Stevens continually pressed Moses and Spargo for more business, telling them frankly that the influence he was using on their behalf entitled him to it, and no matter how much he was given, he was never satisfied. So insistent became his demands that in a secret memo in 1953, Spargo told Moses, "The only way you can satisfy Mallory Stevens is to give him the business now handled by Shanahan's friend." The dilemma was resolved by Stevens' decision to leave the legislature for a bank presidency. A charting of the legal fees and other emoluments that Moses distributed to lawyers during the post-war era, a year-by-year analysis of who got the fees, when they started getting them, and when they stopped getting them, provides almost a year-by-year chart of the fluctuations in the political influence of certain key Democratic lawyers. The influence of two lawyers did not fluctuate. During the entire post-war era, no matter which Democratic factions were in power, it remained, year after year, steady and immense. And, year after year, these two lawyers received a steady flow of legal fees, immense legal fees, from Moses-controlled enterprises. One was Samuel I. Rosenman, who, as a hustling young lawyer a quarter of a century before, had needed a boost from Moses just to stay in public service, but who had then begun drafting speeches for gubernatorial candidate Franklin D. Roosevelt, and who in the decades since had become an advisor to presidents, a small but crucial part of history. In 1970, a political advertisement, seeking to capitalize on Rosenman's endorsement in an election, told voters, "When Sam Rosenman talks, you should listen. Roosevelt did, Truman did, Lehman did." A judge, a president of the Association of the Bar of the City of New York, a figure of prestige so awesome that it seemed to blot from the memory of even old acquaintances the fact that he had once been Sammy the Rose, Jimmy Hines Assemblyman, a representative in Albany of one of the most notorious of all the old-line Tammany leaders. The other was a less public figure. Monroe Goldwater was a playmate of Ed Flynn's boyhood. When in 1922 Flynn became boss of the Bronx, Goldwater, a skilled attorney, became the boss's law partner. During the decades in which Flynn made the power, Goldwater made the money, millions, perhaps tens of millions, for both of them. During Roosevelt's presidency, Flynn was forced to spend considerable time on delicate presidential missions. While Flynn was at Yalta or in Moscow, Goldwater kept Flynn's machine in line. Flynn's death in 1953 seemed almost to increase rather than diminish Goldwater's influence, freeing it to spread beyond the Bronx until it permeated every center of power in the New York democracy. A courteous man, with a gentle, benign manner, Goldwater was nevertheless master of any political situation, no matter how rough, a fact that could be ascertained with remarkable speed by a contractor whose campaign contribution did not meet Goldwater's expectations. Wagner selected the quiet, elderly lawyer to manage all three of his mayoral campaigns. Moses was not interested in Rosenman's prestige or Goldwater's skill with a brief. He was interested in their behind-the-scenes political clout, and he knew that in post-war New York, they possessed more of that commodity than any other Democratic attorneys. "Enormous," he would say of Rosenman's influence. He never talked about Goldwater publicly if he could help it. And both of them were consistently on his team. Rosenman was his personal attorney, a job for which he may or may not have received a fee, and special counsel to his authority, a title Moses modeled on the one special counsel to the president under which Rosenman had served Roosevelt and Truman, on a retainer described as very substantial. And a retainer was only one of the emoluments Rosenman received from public works with which Moses was connected. A single Title I developer, for example, gave his law firm a legal fee of $250,000. Other attorneys, possessed of lesser amounts of political influence, received Triborough legal fees, but smaller fees, handed out in precise ratio to the amount of influence over the city's governmental structure that they possessed. As Charles J. Preuss became closer and closer to Mayor Wagner, for example, he received larger and larger portions of Moses' largesse. If many of the key Democratic politicians in New York City seemed organized now into a retainer regiment, it was Robert Moses who was leading the regiment out. In lockstep, Moses' fees did not come free. There was a price attached. He was buying men's influence, and for each dollar he spent, he made sure he received in return full value. The price was not demanded outright. Moses did not directly ask recipients of his fees to return the favor by voting in legislature or city council for one of his proposals, or by persuading legislators or councilmen to vote for the proposal. He did not ask them directly for support of any kind. Asking would have placed both him and them in violation of the law and of various codes of ethics. And he neither performed himself nor asked anyone else to perform any illegal act. Few of the recipients of Moses' fees were as blunt about the services they were expected to render in return as Mallory Stevens, who, asked late one night by his Albany suite mate, Reuben Lazarus, why he invariably supported Moses' legislation while opposing that backed by Austin Tobin, replied, "Because Tobin doesn't give me anything." The exercise of influence was seldom as dramatic as Samuel Rosenman's hasty plane trip to Albany in 1957 after Harriman announced that he would veto Moses' St. Lawrence Power Project because of the preferential contract terms it offered big aluminum producers. On Moses' instructions, Rosenman flew to the Capitol, went to see the governor, and that same day persuaded him not to veto Moses' proposal. Moreover, no evidence has been found of specific fees being given for specific favors. Moses did not operate by demanding direct quid pro quos. Rather, it was a case of being on his team or not being on his team. Politicians and officeholders who consistently supported his proposals were considered on the team, and men who were on the team were generally also on the payroll. And the overall record is very clear. When a mayor or a governor turned to a man on Moses' payroll for advice, often not knowing that the man was on that payroll, the advice given was invariably the advice that Moses wanted given. When a Moses proposal was before city or state legislative body, legislators secretly on Moses' payroll, or controlled by men secretly on Moses' payroll, were generally the legislators pushing hardest for adoption of Moses' proposal. If Moses was purchasing influence, these men were peddling influence. In terms of money, the terms in which corruption is usually measured, Robert Moses was not himself corrupt. He was, in fact, as uninterested in obtaining payoffs for himself as any public servant who ever lived. In the politician's phrase, he was money honest. But in terms of power, Robert Moses was corrupt. Coveting it, he used money to get it. And because he had so much money, in his fields far more than the city, and so much freedom, in his fields far more than the city, in spending it, within the city he became the locus of corruption, money corruption. Consider his relationship with Tom Shanahan. Shanahan's nostrils twitched to a single aroma, the smell of money. Even as a boy at the turn of the century, one of seven children of a poor Irish boilermaker, he had followed that scent to its source. The noses of his Waterbury, Connecticut playmates may have been flattened against candy store windows. Tom Shanahan's nose was pressed against the glass front door of Waterbury's Colonial Trust Company. Reminiscing 40 years later, he would recall vividly passing that building almost every day of his youth and staring inside almost every time he passed. It had been, he would say, a place of august halls. From as far back as he could remember, he would say, he had wanted to be a banker. He followed the scent down to the great city after high school, but for long years he seemed to have followed it into a trap. The tall, strong young man spent 7 years behind the barred windows of tellers' cages. He went to NYU at night, in 1926 earned a degree, but 5 years later still had a job only slightly better, assistant cashier, at one of the smallest and shakiest banks in the city, the 8-year-old Federation Bank and Trust Company. But when, in 1931, the Depression forced the infant institution to shut its doors, it was the assistant cashier who, with Federation's despairing officers ready to liquidate, thought up a complex refinancing plan that reduced the bank's obligations, personally talked a financier into loaning it the money to pay them off, and saved the bank. When it reopened, Shanahan, at 29, was its vice president and treasurer. With authority, Shanahan was able to move Federation into a field from which more conservative bankers shied: loans to construction contractors. The age of huge construction companies was still in the future. During the Depression, most of New York's contractors were small and broke. Tom would take a contractor who didn't have the salary to pay his workers that week and back him, an associate recalls. He went on face value, and he very seldom went wrong. He backed Pete DiNapoli. The story around Federation in later years was that when DiNapoli first came in to see Shanahan, he had to borrow a nickel for carfare home to Queens. And the Slattery Contracting Company, which was better off, but barely, and a half dozen others, who were to make immense profits, and who deposited those profits with Federation. He proposed giving junior officers of the bank greater responsibility. More cautious elements protested. The bank, after all, had only one office. Shanahan told them not to worry. He'd bring in the business, he said. He just wanted to make sure that there would be enough people around trained to handle it. He was as good as his word. By 1944, Federation had $30 million in assets. And increasingly, Federation's assets were his assets. For years, he had been quietly buying up the bank's stock. When, in 1944, the one-time bank teller was elected bank president, he owned shares worth millions of dollars. Shanahan's rise may have been as dramatic as one of Horatio Alger's heroes, but it was less publicized. He shunned fame with the same diligence with which he had sought wealth. Not a single newspaper or magazine story provides more than the most cursory details of his life, and he had reason to shun fame. Since 1941, his activities had involved politics as well as banking, and his political activities were not ones that would appear attractive in the spotlight. It was not for principle, but for profit, that he had entered politics. His political philosophy seems to have begun and ended with a violent hatred of commies. The expression on the big Irishman's face would contort into a snarl, and the eyes behind the steel-rimmed glasses would glitter with rage when he discussed the left-wing conspiracy that he felt was trying to take over the city. Planning to name him a delegate to the 1952 Democratic National Convention, friends would be embarrassed to learn that he was not eligible because he had not bothered to register to vote. But his dealings with contractors had shown him that their dependence on governmental contracts could be turned to personal financial advantage. The contractors owed Shanahan much. He transferred part of that debt to the Democratic Party, raising so much money from them for the party's 1941 mayoral candidate, William O'Dwyer, that when O'Dwyer decided to run again in 1945, he made Shanahan his campaign manager. And soon after O'Dwyer was sworn in, a pattern in which politics and profit were intertwined, began to emerge on Shanahan's loom. The contractors he had persuaded to contribute to the Democratic Party were being handed lucrative construction contracts by Democratic government officials and were depositing the profits from those contracts in his bank. In 1948, when Shanahan was 46, O'Dwyer appointed him, with an absolute minimum of publicity, to the City Housing Authority. Housing Authority memberships were non-paying, but in Shanahan's case, that adjective may have applied only to salary. Within a remarkably short time after he was sworn in, the word was out around town, not only among contractors, but among architects, landscape architects, engineers, insurance brokers, real estate appraisers, among, in fact, every profession whose members wanted to work for the authority. You had to do business with Tom Shanahan, do your banking at Shanahan's bank, and kick back a portion of your profits to Shanahan, presumably for the Democratic Party, or forget about your chances. And even after you had obtained an authority contract, the word went, your business with Shanahan was not finished. When you submitted the bill for your work, further payoffs would be required, or somehow the bill would keep getting lost in the authority's files, and you would not get paid. The banker quickly became, in the words of one Reform Democrat, one of the most notorious boodle boys around town. Warren Moscow, who was able to do his perceiving from an excellent vantage point, he was executive director of the Housing Authority for 2 years, could say of the banker, he was a very personable guy, but I would say that ethically Tom left something to be desired all the way down the line. It was common knowledge. No, I won't say common knowledge, it was common gossip that an architect who wanted to get an assignment from the Housing Authority had to turn $15,000 over to Tom Shanahan, theoretically for the Democratic Party. Theoretically, Moscow said, and the meaning behind that word was echoed by others who came into contact with Tom Shanahan, for even insiders who took the relationship of money and politics as a matter of course were taken aback by Shanahan's greed. We all knew what Shanahan was, Monroe Goldwater says, the wrinkles of his aged face forming a pattern of disgust at the recollection. If little publicity attended Shanahan's rise in banking, less attended his rise in politics. For years, there was scarcely a mention of his name in political stories in New York newspapers. There is no mention at all in the supposedly definitive history of Tammany Hall. But Shanahan was, for more than a decade, Tammany's money man, the individual who, more than any other, greased the wheels of the machine. He was the hub of political payoffs and influence peddling in New York, the center of all those elements in the city's government that lay hidden and festering beneath its facade. And for most of that time, he was Robert Moses' closest associate in that government. In a machine oiled by money, the influence of the money man was, of course, enormous. In a machine that danced to the jingle of coins, Shanahan had a large say in calling the tune. And Moses made sure that the tune was his tune. The insurance premiums to the broker, friend of Tom Shanahan's, were $27,978 per year. But they were a minor item in the list of triborough fees parceled out to Shanahan. The fees to Shanahan's bank for banking services, fees as paying agent for triborough bonds, for example, which required little work and which other banks would have liked to have, but which other banks were not allowed to bid for, amounted to tens of thousands of dollars on a single issue of triborough bonds. But these were minor items, too. For the payoffs that really mattered in the Moses-Shanahan relationship were figured not in thousands of dollars, but in millions. On Moses' order, in 1948, the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority deposited in the Federation Bank and Trust Company, which at the time had deposits of only $35 million, $15 million, thereby increasing the bank's capital assets by 40% at a single stroke. This money was placed in accounts on which Federation paid no interest, so that the bank had its use to lend out and earn interest without paying a cent for it. And it was left in those accounts for the entire decade that Shanahan remained in power, so that the bank had its use for 10 years. During the 50s, on Moses' order, Triborough shipped to Federation $48,963,000 in authority-owned investment securities, in violation of every prudent business principle, because, at the time he did so, the bank did not have sufficient total resources sufficient to cover that amount if the securities were lost, and left them there, allowing the bank the advantages that accrued from their possession, for years. Moses placed at Shanahan's disposal not only his money, but his power, which Shanahan used to make more money. During his first 5 years as Housing Authority Vice Chairman, Shanahan, with the help of the two Moses men on the five-member authority, Chairman Philip J. Cruz and Architect William Wilson, dispensed authority contracts as he wished. When Wagner became mayor in 1954, however, he wanted the authority under his control. Naming Moscow executive director, he directed him to inform Cruz, whose term was expiring, that he would be reappointed only on his solemn promise to give his loyalties henceforth to the mayor instead of Moses. And, Moscow dryly relates, Cruz made his divorce. Knowing Shanahan, the Wagner High Command, while friendly to the banker, was far from confident that all the kickbacks he accepted as contributions to the Democratic Party were actually reaching the party's coffers. That was one of the things they put me in to do, quite simply, to take control of the assigning of architects away from Shanahan, Moscow says. Before he could act, however, the banker made a request that would increase rather than decrease his power, for a personal executive assistant. Suspicious that Shanahan wanted such a personal representative primarily as a bagman, an intermediary who could collect the kickbacks and keep the banker's hands clean, Moscow objected to the appointment, and was backed by Cruz and the authority's two non-Moses members. Shanahan, even more florid than usual, his eyes glaring coldly from behind the steel-rimmed glasses, stalked out of the boardroom and said he would not return until his request was granted. But for months, the authority stood firm. Authority members had long dreaded the possibility of an exposé by some red-hunting newspaper of the fact that some authority social workers had once, during the idealistic 30s, belonged, even if only briefly, to some organization later labeled as a communist front. Early in 1957, with Shanahan's boycott still a failure, Moses' man Wilson raised the question of the vice chairman's executive assistant again. Recalls Moscow, "It was in a meeting of the authority. The five members of the authority were there, and me with the assistant to the chairman, and Wilson said in so many words, 'I have a message for you from Mr. Moses. You give Tom what he wants, or we'll turn the Daily News loose on you. You have 10 days. Tom got what he wanted, and for another 2 years continued to exercise considerable control over the authority and to collect campaign contributions from its contractors. Naming Shanahan vice chairman of the mayor's slum clearance committee, Moses virtually delegated him absolute power over certain of its projects. Monroe Goldwater found this out when he was retained as attorney by a group of real estate men who wanted to sponsor one. Moses put it on Shanahan, the attorney recalls. He said, "You know I can't do everything myself. I have to let Tom have some of the jobs. This is Tom's job. Go see him." When Goldwater approached the banker, however, Shanahan reacted as the attorney had suspected he would. Shanahan said, "Well, I don't know about this." I said, "Don't you think it's your job to take the low bidder, to consider the rate of return they want and the rate of interest they will have to pay and the quality of the men involved?" He said, "Well, there can be a slight variation." I said, "Look, cut out the crap with me, Tom. Are you committed to somebody?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, I'm going to make an issue of this with Moses. I'll tell you this right now. Without even knowing what rate of return the other people want, my people will give it to you at 0.5% less." I went to see Moses, but he said, "I can't do this with Tom. Tom is committed to these people." And he refused to intervene. Thus supported by Moses, Shanahan used his vice chairmanship as a lever to force prospective slum clearance sponsors to do business with him. A part of my deal was that I had to do my banking at Shanahan's bank, one was to relate. Federation's assets, already on the climb, began to climb faster. In 1948, the year in which its president was appointed to the Slum Clearance Committee, they were $35 million. In 1959, the year in which he resigned from the post, they were almost $200 million. And Shanahan's personal holdings in Federation stock were worth $20 million. Moses put his vast reserves of money and power at Shanahan's disposal. Shanahan put his vast reserves of influence at Moses. The banker was interested in who got housing authority and urban renewal contracts. Unconcerned with the aims and principles of government, he wasn't interested in where housing authority and urban renewal projects were located, why they were located there, or how they were built, the factors that Moses was interested in. The banker ran the housing authority for Moses. The housing authority projects built were the projects Moses wanted built, on the sites where Moses wanted them built, to the specifications Moses desired. In 1953, when Shanahan's term expired, Moses wrote in Pelletieri, "It is of the utmost importance that Tom be reappointed." It was to him. The influence Shanahan exercised for Moses was not limited to housing or urban renewal. Time and time again, on highway proposals by Moses on which the city's officials were divided, the banker's power helped tip the scales in Moses' favor. In dealing with DeSapio and Shanahan and Goldwater and Rosenman and Steingut and Rowe and Preuss, Moses was, as always, going straight to the top. Charles F. Rodriguez, representing vacationing Bronx Borough President James J. Lyons on the Board of Estimate during the controversy over Moses' proposal to construct Shea Stadium, had received no instructions on the matter, and, believing that the city had more pressing uses for the $21 million involved, was considering voting against it when the telephone in his office rang. And the voice on the other end of the line wasn't that of his boss, but of his boss's boss. "I think if Jim was here, he'd go along," Charles A. Buckley said gently. "You do it, and if there's any question, ask Jim to see me." Rodriguez did it, and there was never any question. As a state senator would admit privately, describing Moses' methods in Albany, "He wouldn't bother with us at all. He went right to the leaders." As old-time Tammany ward bosses had distributed Christmas baskets filled with turkeys and sugar plums in decades past, Robert Moses distributed Christmas baskets now. But he distributed them not to voters, and not, at least not primarily, to the men the voters had elected to office, but to the men who controlled the men the voters had elected to office, many of the most powerful men in the city and state. His ward, his district, was the uppermost precincts of politics. "There's only one way to hold a district," explained George Washington Plunkett, who held his for 30 years. "You must study human nature and act accordin'." Moses studied human nature in his district and acted accordin'. His constituents, the DeSapios and Shanahans and Steinguts, wanted the rich Christmas baskets of honest graft. Moses handed them baskets. Using the vast wealth of his public authorities, he made himself the ward boss of the highest precincts, bankroller of the inner circle, dancing master of the 400 of politics. And he held his district for 30 years. Doling out sugar plums to such men gave him power over them in another way, too, as Wagner, in a very private talk in 1961, referred to in the introduction, tried to explain to Paul R. Scrivain. The mayor was personally fond of Scrivain, a younger man he had taken under his wing years before and guided through the political thickets, and, just a year earlier, into the city council presidency, informing him that he would be city liaison to Moses World's Fair. The mayor leaned toward him and said earnestly, "Paul, my experience with Moses has taught me one lesson, and I'll tell it to you. I would never let him do anything for me in any way, shape, or form. I'd never ask him or permit him to do anything of a personal nature for me, because, and I've seen it time and time again, a day will come when Bob will reach back in his file and throw this in your face, quietly, if that will make you go along with him, publicly otherwise. And if he has to, he will destroy you with it." Scrivain admired, idolized would scarcely be too strong a word, Moses. He was loath to believe Wagner's warning. "But," he recalls, "during a series of battles in the Fair Executive Committee, I saw it happen time and time again. Bob Moses had these files. On at least 20 separate occasions when we were on the same side, I would say about someone, 'I don't think he'll go along.' And Bob would say, 'Well, God damn it, he'd better go along. If he doesn't go along, I'll destroy the son of a bitch.' And he'd call for a file, and he would begin to quote chapter and verse. And sure enough, when the vote came, the fellow would go along." No one could dwell long in the inner circles of New York politics without knowing about Moses' files, the dossiers he had compiled on the men with whom he had to deal. Their existence was so open a secret that Times reporter Joseph C. Ingraham, a particular friend of Moses, assigned by an editor to investigate the financial affairs of a Tammany borough president, knew exactly where to start looking. He telephoned Moses and asked for the file on the borough president, and there inside it, documented and photostated, complete down to deeds and incorporation certificates, the reporter found the records of real estate transactions in which the borough president had engaged, transactions based on his foreknowledge, acquired through his official position, of the routes of certain Moses-built highways. Politicians who had accepted favors from Moses knew that the documentation of those favors was in his dossiers, and they knew that Moses would use that documentation to destroy them if they ever refused to go along with his wishes. They had accepted a favor from him perhaps once. He had a hold over them forever. A politician who had never accepted a favor from Moses knew that this did not grant him immunity from such attack. He knew that Moses' bloodhounds were sniffing, always sniffing, around City Hall and the files in the municipal building, and he could be sure that up at Randall's Island there was a file with his name on it, and who knew what might be in it. "Man," as Willie Stark put it in All the King's Men, "is born in sin and dies in corruption." Or, in the words of Jack Lutsky, who during his quarter of a century in City Hall earned a reputation as a fearless and honest man, "Is there anyone who sometime in his life hasn't done something he is ashamed of?" Well, you always had the feeling that Moses knew about that something, and that he had the proof of it in those files of his, and that if he needed to, he would use it. Politicians knew what use Moses could make of his dossiers. They had seen him give newspaper leaks or issue statements that dredged up for public view and turned into blaring headlines the dark secrets of men's pasts. It was not just the force of greed that Robert Moses used in bending men to his will. In some cases, it was also the force of fear. If you stayed on his team, moreover, he would take care of you even after you were too old to play. For his own purposes, of course. He would take care of you until you died. William Wilson was, to Warren Musco, only Moses' stooge, but he was a well-paid stooge. Wagner kicked him off the Housing Authority in 1954 when he was 73 years old. Moses promptly supplemented his city retirement benefits with a $10,000 per year authority consultantship. When Edwin Salmon was forced out of the $15,000 City Planning Commission chairmanship that Moses had obtained for him, Moses asked Brooklyn Borough President John Cashmore to give him a job, and a $15,000 salary, on his personal staff. There was no job open, Cashmore said. Then make a new job, was Moses' reply. A new job was made. Paul Scrivain remembers running for the 1965 Democratic nomination for mayor after Wagner retired, and losing, and waking up on the morning after the primary wondering what he was going to do with the rest of his life. Bob had three jobs lined up for me, he says, and these were not just ordinary jobs. Moses offered Scrivain his choice of the presidency of a consulting engineering firm whose president had just died, a full, lucrative partnership in another engineering firm, and he had another authority in mind, and I could be chairman and write my own ticket. Says Scrivain, Bob always took care of people who cooperated with him. If you cooperated. If you tried, even occasionally, not to cooperate. If you dropped off the team. If ever you exercised your responsibility to the public rather than your responsibility to Robert Moses, you were out in the cold until you died. There would be no consulting jobs, no authority make work, and if the rumors were true, when the state retirement board met to certify your pension, it would somehow turn out to be less, far less, than you had believed you were entitled to. As Lazarus puts it, he didn't want anyone who had been on the inside with him to talk about the way he operated. This way, he was buying their silence to the grave. Moses demanded allegiance only in the areas he had staked out for his own, but that allegiance had, in those areas, to be total. And with most of his constituents, it was. He not only held his district, he controlled it absolutely. He was, in his fields, the boss of the bosses. He did not extend his field of force only over individuals, of course. One cannot dip a toe into the water of New York politics without sensing, moving somewhere deep beneath the surface, the presence of an enormous force, a power unseen but immense, the power of banks. Banks control the dispensing of huge amounts of insurance, and they can dispense it to politicians. Their activities generate immense amounts of legal work, and they can dispense the least onerous and most lucrative aspects of that work, local real estate closings, for example, to politicians. They can give politicians access to the inside financial information on which fortunes are made by electing them to their boards of directors, and they can give them fortunes more directly by giving them blocks of their own stock at favorable prices, or more directly still, by giving them unsecured loans, which allow them to make investments without the inconvenience or risk of using their own money, and by giving them those loans at interest rates so favorable that the investments can hardly help resulting in a profit. They can give politicians loans of a size that make them rich beyond their dreams. The acceptance of these and other favors puts politicians in the bank's debt. Banks are very good at collecting debts. They collect them with interest, and they collect politicians' debts with interest, the public interest. Decade after decade, what banks wanted from Albany or City Hall, banks got. Some political analysts speak of the influence of New York's banks as influence exerted almost entirely on the Republican Party. But it is not only Republicans who are interested in money. The power of the great banks of New York crosses party as well as county lines. Within the overall political structure of New York, city and state, it is all-pervasive and immense. And Moses enlisted it behind his aims. Banks have one aim, making money. Moses was sure their aim and his coincided. He made sure that banks would make money. Quick money, easy money, safe money, from his public works. Revenue bonds, the key to his authority's existence and power, were the key to the alliance. Banks needed authority bonds. Forbidden by federal law from putting the money deposited with them by the public into any but the very safest investments, the very best of what bankers call good high-grade paper, barred specifically from purchasing corporate stock and by inference reinforced by continuous evaluation of their investment portfolios by government regulatory overseers, from purchasing any bonds and notes except those of the most solid corporations, of governments, and of public authorities. 4 years of investment-stifling war had left them loaded with cash, impatient to put it to work earning more cash, and with a drastically insufficient supply of good, high-grade paper into which to put it. Jack Madigan, who had spent weeks trying to peddle Henry Hudson Bridge bonds around Wall Street in 1936, was astonished when previously aloof bank presidents began inviting him to lunch in their private dining rooms in 1946, until one, Stuart Becker, president of the Bank of Manhattan, casually remarked over dessert, "You know, Jack, we've got more money than good uses for it." Then he understood. Returning from Becker's table, he told Moses that the banker was asking to be allowed to buy as much as possible of the next Triborough bond issue. And the bartender's son added that he would never have to go hat in hand to bankers again. From now on, bankers would come to him. "It's just supply and demand," he would explain simply. The demand for Triborough's bonds was far greater than the supply. Of all possible investments legal for banks, moreover, public authority bonds were the most desirable. In selecting investments, bankers had three aims: to keep their money safe, to make as much money as possible with it, and to keep the money they made. Keeping money meant, in post-war America, tax exemption. Corporate bonds were dependent upon corporate profits, so much more risky than bridge tolls. Their yield was higher, in 1968, 8% to about 5%. But banks had to pay half of their profits, 52%, later 48%, to the government in taxes, so their yield from a corporate bond would, in terms of money kept, be only 4%. So tax-exempt authority bonds had both greater safety and a higher return than corporate bonds. United States government bonds were as safe as authority bonds, their yield as high, but that yield was subject to state and local taxes. Their net yield was lower. State and municipal bonds, exempt from taxes, had net yields about the same as authority bonds. But in Wall Street's view, they were not as safe, since states and municipalities always seemed to be in financial difficulties and were continually being forced to go to the voters for permission to raise taxes. And who could predict what voters would do? Authorities, on the other hand, grew continually more prosperous from revenues guaranteed by covenants that were sacred contracts, safe from public whim or will. During the first post-war quarter century, New York City's bonds fluctuated fairly substantially in the ratings they were given for safety. Triborough's held steady, year after year, at AAA, the highest rating given. Ask New York bankers why they are so eager to buy public authority bonds, and they begin, as does Duane Saunders, vice president of the investment division of the Chemical Bank, by speaking sanctimoniously of our feelings of responsibility to the community by financing projects that will benefit it. But the longer one talks to bankers, the less the talk is of responsibility and the more it dwells on more mundane considerations. A Triborough bond is a very, very high-quality instrument, you know, Saunders says, and they are paying, say, 5.40, which is almost 11%. There are corporates out there, but no government stuff. You're always matching yield against safety in this business. Any portfolio manager will try within his limits to maximize his yields. He becomes very, very interested in yield. And authority bonds are the highest yielding of any investment-grade security after tax. Higher yielding than any other safe investment. Higher yielding, in fact, than most risky investments. Higher yielding even than those riskiest of investments, personal loans. A public authority bond is simply the best investment a bank can make, by far. Of all public authority bonds, moreover, none were more desirable to banks than Triborough's, by design. Moses wanted banks to be so anxious to purchase Triborough bonds that they would use all of their immense power to force elected officials to give his public works proposals the approval that would result in their issuance. So although the safety of the bank's money was already amply assured by Triborough's current earnings, so great that each year the authority collected far more money than it spent, by the irrevocable covenants guaranteeing that tolls could never be removed without the bondholders' consent, and by Triborough's monopoly, also irrevocable, that guaranteed them that if any future intra-city water crossing were built, they would share in its tolls too, Moses provided them with additional assurances. He maintained huge cash reserves. "Fantastic," says Jackson Phillips, director of municipal research for Dun & Bradstreet. "The last time I looked, they had 10 years' interest on reserve." And when he floated the Verrazano bonds he agreed to lay aside, in addition to the existing reserves, 15%, $45 million, of the cash he received for the new bond issue, and not touch it until the bridge was open and operating 5 years later. Purchasers of the Verrazano bonds could be all but certain that they could collect their interest every year, even if the bridge never collected a single toll. Small wonder that Phillips says, "Triboroughs are just about the best bonds there are." Wall Streeters may believe that any investment is a bet, but Robert Moses was certainly running the safest game in town. An additional margin of safety, moreover, was provided by Moses' reputation. Moses never hesitated to give Wall Street the impression that he would go all out to protect their interests. Phillips says, "We all knew," says a banker, "that Moses would fight for his bondholders." During the previous 22 years of its existence, the State Power Authority had never been able to interest the street in even small proposed bond offerings. In 1954, Moses was named its chairman, and he offered for sale an issue of more than $1 billion, the largest revenue bond offering in history. "There was some caution," Phillips recalls, "but there was the feeling, look, Moses is doing this." The issue sold out in 4 days. Holders of Port Authority bonds were perturbed, although without cause, when, in 1960, New York and New Jersey legislatures teamed up to force it to use its surplus revenues to take over the deficit-ridden Hudson and Manhattan tubes. But holders of Triborough bonds had no such worries. Triborough's annual surpluses may have been huge, more than $20 million per year and climbing, but Moses made sure that every cent was committed to future revenue, not deficit-producing projects. Wall Street loved him for this, Phillips says. And Wall Street knew Moses had the power to make these commitments stick. The Municipal Forum of New York is a group of extremely conservative municipal finance and bond analysts who generally accord guests no more than perfunctory applause. Whenever Robert Moses appeared before the forum, its members, those hard-eyed men of finance, stood as one for an ovation. Moses offered bankers more than safety. A high return on their money was already assured, in abundance, by the bond's tax-exempt status. But Moses provided bankers with a still higher return. The interest rates on his bonds were higher than they needed to be to attract buyers. So much higher that, over the life of a single bond issue, the one floated to finance the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, bondholders would receive the almost incredible amount of $40 million more than they would gladly have settled for. And favored bankers didn't have to wait for years to make money on Moses' bonds. He made it possible for them to make money in a single day. Banks make quick profits on bonds through underwriting, a procedure in which they agree to purchase bonds from the issuing agency in the hope of reselling at a profit those they can't afford to keep themselves. In the case of Triborough's bonds, of course, hope was an inaccurate term. No matter what the state of the market, every post-war Triborough bond issue was sold out, with many buyers still clamoring for them within 24 hours after the underwriting banks offered them for sale. In the case of Triborough's bonds, therefore, the underwriters risk the possibility that they may not be able to sell the bonds, which is the rationale for the profits underwriters are allowed to make, was negligible. And Moses made sure that the underwriters' profits would be huge. He allowed the Verrazano Underwriting Syndicate, for example, to purchase $300 million worth of bonds from Triborough for $295,760,851. Since these bonds were sold on the same day they were issued for $300,570,851, the syndicate reaped a one-day profit of almost $5 million. Then there were the smaller morsels. There were, for example, the service fees that Triborough paid banks for authenticating and delivering the bonds, for acting as paying agents for the semi-annual interest payments, or for acting as trustee for the bonds, a job which involved studying the resolution, collecting an annual administrative fee for routine duties connected with it, collecting and cremating the coupons amassed by the paying agents, and collecting the bonds when the issue was redeemed. These fees, 4 cents per coupon for paying agents, for example, seemed small, although Moses' fees were higher than others paid for similar work. But, paid out twice a year, year after year, for the 40-year life of the bonds, they mounted up. Selection as a repository of Triborough deposits was similarly profitable. Moses' agreement to set aside $45 million as a 5-year interest reserve was in effect an agreement to leave on deposit in banks $45 million on which the banks would not have to pay any interest, but on which they could, by lending it out, collect interest. Moses' generosity to banks had to be paid for out of the pockets of motorists, of course. If bondholders received tens of millions of dollars extra in interest, drivers would have to pay tens of millions of dollars extra in tolls. The state's public authorities law supposedly keeps the cost to the public of public works as low as possible by prescribing the use of open, competitive bidding on bond sales and all other details of authority operation. But Moses wasn't concerned with the cost to the public. His concern was to enlist in his cause the banks who could use their power to push behind-the-scenes political leaders, as well as state legislators, city councilmen, borough presidents, and mayors and governors, into approving a public work that they might otherwise not have approved. Open bidding would have defeated this purpose. Banks would not push hard for a public work if they knew that after it was approved, they would have to bid against other banks for its bonds, and might not get them at all. Banks would only push hard if they knew before the work was approved that they would profit from it. So Moses let them know. He inserted in the public authorities law a section, 561, that permitted the Triborough Authority to sell its bonds at either open sales or through private placement. And, of course, he invariably selected private placement, with the banks that had been working with Madigan on the issue since its earliest stages. And since the aim of the use of private placement was to place power behind his proposals, he selected as the favored banks those that had the most power to place there. Chase, mighty Chase, had the most. The Chase Manhattan Bank and the Rockefeller family that controlled it. Chase, the principal 20th century repository and instrument of the wealth and power of the 19th century Standard Oil robber baron, traditionally, as Theodore H. White notes, raised the big New York money for Republicans. William O'Dwyer, who tried to buck its power once, found out just how much it had, and later commented bitterly, "There's a dictator in New York City, and I'll tell you who it is. It's the Chase Manhattan Bank." Not that Chase's power was confined to state or city. During the post-war quarter century, the Chase Manhattan Bank was very probably the single most powerful financial institution on the face of the earth. And the Chase Manhattan Bank was selected by Moses as the trustee of Triborough's bonds, and hence was the single largest recipient of the lucrative service fees connected with them. The Chemical Bank began wheeling and dealing behind the political scenes increasingly during the post-war era, executing an end run around the Federal Corrupt Practices Act by having various officers and directors establish and contribute heavily to a fund for good government that in its turn made heavy political contributions, notably to the Nassau GOP machine and the Bronx Democratic Organization headed by House Public Works Chairman Charles A. Buckley. The Chemical Bank was the second largest recipient of Triborough service fees. A chemical officer, asked if the bank had ever purchased Triborough bonds, replied, "We bought a ton of them." The remaining service fees, and the lucrative underwriting profits, and the right to purchase Triborough bonds direct from the source, were divided up among the Morgan Guarantee Trust, the Marine Midland Bank, the Manufacturers Hanover Trust, and the United States Trust, a quartet of banks, each of which possessed considerable political clout. The assets of such banks dwarfed the $200 million of which Tom Shanahan at Federation Bank and Trust was so proud. Chase's assets in 1974 were $30 billion, and so did their power. And now this power, the power of the greatest pool of liquid capital in the civilized world, was at the service of Robert Moses. He had a friend at Chase Manhattan, and the friend was its president. "No one will ever be able to thank you adequately for the contributions you have made to the city," David Rockefeller wrote him. He had a friend at virtually every major financial institution in New York. Says one observer of the New York political scene, "Whenever Moses made a proposal, and I mean over a period of years and years and years, you could invariably be sure that behind the scenes, the banks would be pushing for that proposal. Pushing hard." It wasn't just bankers' grays that Robert Moses had marching behind him. It was blue collars and hard hats, too. Despising working men and their organizations, and desiring to drive men, to hire and fire them as he pleased, to hold their economic fate at his mercy, he had naturally despised labor unions. "Let her invoke whatever law she chose," he had told Francis Perkins during the 30s. "No union bricklayer would ever work at Jones Beach." But by the post-war 40s, labor unions had acquired immense power in New York. Their million-plus members formed the base of the Democratic Party's popular support, and their campaign contributions, contributions not only of money from their seemingly bottomless war chests, but of services such as sound trucks and campaign brochure printing, and of manpower to perform the vital doorbell ringing and election day transportation functions once performed by ward healers, were indispensable. If the banks hid their power, the unions flaunted theirs. Thanks to a special legislative privilege granted to no other organization, there was slapped down on the desk of every senator and assemblyman each morning, right next to the official calendar of pending bills, another marked calendar for his guidance, a calendar on which was stamped, beside every bill in which organized labor had an interest, "This bill approved or disapproved by the New York State AFL-CIO. And they had it to flaunt. No Democratic candidate ran for office without intoning some version of Robert F. Wagner Jr.'s oft-repeated incantation, "This is a good, fine union town, and as long as I'm mayor, I intend to keep it that way." In Moses' field of operation, the key union figures, Harry Van Arsdale and Peter J. Brennan, later President Nixon's Secretary of Labor, had substantial power to influence government. Moses' contempt for working men and the unions that represented them had not changed, but emotions such as contempt had long since been subordinated to his desire for power. Invited to lunch at Randall's Island, Van and Pete, as their host was soon calling them, found themselves the object of all Moses' easy, flattering, gracious charm. Of his earlier hatred for all they represented, they could detect not a trace. "Bob used to have a lot of fights with my predecessor," Pete Brennan says, "but he got to know us, and we got to know him." And Van Arsdale and Brennan liked what they got to know. Their background was in the predominantly Irish Catholic conservative building trades. Van Arsdale, who ran the city's Central Labor Council, representative of 550 different unions, like a construction foreman ramrodding a gang of laborers, had been a member of the Electricians Union at 17. Brennan had worked his way up to president of the 255,000-member Building and Construction Trades Council, and the trades' hard hats were no harder than the prejudices of the men who wore them. There therefore existed areas of ideological agreement with Moses that went beyond his liking for the Irish, including their feelings about Negroes and Puerto Ricans and the necessity of keeping them in their place. If there was a labor force in New York with a lower percentage of non-whites than the building trades locals, it was, after all, the workforce at Jones Beach. Van Arsdale and Brennan soon discovered that on Moses' contracts there would be none of the tiresome insistence on opening up the locals.